Hi. I wanted to start by thanking Debbie for inviting me to be part of this year's panel, and thank all of you for spending a few moments with us this afternoon. This is exciting times that we're living in, definitely interesting times that we're living in, and it's always good when we have the opportunity to come together and think about these things in a way that that hopefully will benefit populations that we serve and also public health in general. We've already covered no disclosures. I wanted to do just a quick shameless plug for the Catalyst Center in the beginning here. For those of you who aren't familiar with us, we are funded by the Division of Services for Children with Special Health Needs under the Maternal and Child Health Bureau. We have a cooperative agreement with them. We are based at the Boston University School of Public Health, and we are the National Technical Assistance and Research Center dedicated to the MCHB outcome measure that all children and youth with special health care needs have access to adequate health insurance coverage and financing for the care they need. So different systems think about kids with special health care needs in different ways. I wanted to just take a second to make sure that we all have a shared understanding of the population that we're talking about today. Before I start going into my presentation in a little bit more detail, let's think about the MCHB definition of children with special health care needs, which is up on the screen now. This is the one that I'll be referencing throughout my presentation. As you can see, this is a broad definition that encompasses all aspects of health: physical, developmental, behavioral, and emotional. So what was the coverage status? The question that we're faced with today is, what does the ACA mean for kids with special health care needs thus far? And so let's think back for a second into the dim, dark recesses of the past to 2009, 2010, just before the ACA was passed. What was coverage status for kids with special health care needs like prior to the law? According to the National Survey of Children with Special Health Care Needs, approximately 11 million kids meet the MCHB definition for special health care needs. So this is not an insignificant population. It's about 15% of all kids. And in terms of their coverage status, 52.4% of them had private insurance, 35.9% of them had public coverage. At that time, it was either Medicaid or CHIP. 8.2% of them had dual coverage. They had private coverage as their primary source, and then they had Medicaid as wraparound or secondary coverage. And at the time of the survey, 3.6% of them were uninsured. So kids with special health care needs in general had pretty robust coverage rates. The American Community Survey put the rate of uninsurance for kids in general in 2009 at 8.6%. And the same survey had 20.6% for adults being uninsured in 2009. These are different surveys with different methodologies, but we can say in summary that compared to kids in general, and certainly in comparison to adults, CSHCN had pretty robust coverage rates, which is good news. So how were they impacted by the ACA? One of the primary goals of the ACA, as I'm sure you all know, is to expand coverage. So if most kids with special health care needs already had insurance coverage, does that mean the ACA had any impact on them? I want to spend the next few minutes with you reviewing what we know and highlighting more about what we don't know right now, here at the almost end of the first year of full enrollment, full implementation, in the following areas. In these four areas: universal and continuous coverage, adequate benefits, affordable premiums and cost sharing, and access to care. So everything that Kathy and the previous presenters said about children and MCH populations in general also applies to kids with special health care needs, but I want to try to drill down just a little bit to some specific issues that are relevant to that. A specific concern related to children with special health care needs is the effects of churn. Kathy spoke about this. Churn is when individuals and families drop on and off of certain kinds of coverage due to changes in eligibility. They're triggered by income, changes, life events, births, deaths, marriages, divorces, and employment changes. We have a lot of experience with churn already in Medicaid and CHIP. Because the eligibility for those programs is income sensitive, and the field is relatively narrow, so you don't have to have a lot of movement in terms of income to become ineligible for Medicaid or CHIP. And we expect the same thing to be happening in terms of the subsidies for marketplace coverage. In a 2011 Health Affairs article by Summers and Rosenbaum, Half of those with incomes under 200% of the federal poverty level were predicted to experience a change, at least one income change, that causes cycling between Medicaid or CHIP or marketplace coverage. So we anticipated that there was going to be movement amongst these three publicly subsidized programs. It'll be interesting to see how that actually shakes out when we start getting the numbers in. The big concern post-ACA isn't that children with special health care needs will become uninsured. So churn is when you're moving between coverage sources. Becoming uninsured, you just drop off totally. We're not so worried about that for kids with special health care needs, but we do know that kids with special health care needs are at risk for experiencing changes in benefits, cost sharing, and network access that can impact continuity of care, administrative burden, and financial hardship. We already know from the National Survey of Children with Special Health Care Needs data that these were concerns for this population. And so we're concerned that churn will exacerbate those pre-existing concerns. Churn also drives up the cost for states and for insurers, and it creates a disincentive for payers to make decisions from a life course perspective. Payers, when there's a lot of churn in a market, payers tend to think more about controlling costs for their enrollees today than they do in making an investment in folks that they're going to be financially responsible for in the future. So this is the issue of churn isn't just of concern to kids and families, it's also of concern to policymakers. Adequate benefits, everybody's favorite topic. The topic of adequate benefits is key to understanding. It's key to understanding that you don't bump the little slide presentation thing so it doesn't goof your slides up on you and confuse your audience. The topic of adequate benefits is key to understanding how children with special health care needs are faring under the ACA. The latest iteration, 2009-2010 of the National Survey of Children with Special Health Care Needs tells us that prior to the passage of the law, about approximately 34% of families of kids with special health care needs said that their insurance coverage was inadequate in meeting their child's needs. As you know, the ACA included a requirement that individual policies and small group plans, both in and out of the marketplaces, include an array of essential health benefits, and Kathy went into some detail on that topic in her presentation. The discussion prior to January of this year was around federal rulemaking and states making choices in defining the EHBs under the benchmark approach. Now, here at the almost end of year one, attention is turning to the real-world application of those choices. So the debate up until this point, the conversation up until this point is what is it and what's it going to look like? And now we're going to start thinking, we're going to start moving into a phase where we start thinking about, okay, well, what actually happened in the real world for kids and for families and for states and for payers? We know there's significant variability in the state's choices with regard to the EHBs, with implications specific to children with special health care needs in the areas of benefit substitution, the definition of habilitative services, and the impact of standalone dental plans for kids. And I would point out that NASHB, Kathy's organization, has a really wonderful new policy brief on standalone dental plans for kids on their state reform website, and I would direct your attention to that. It had a very nice discussion in it. The final rules allowed for actuarially equivalent substitutions to be made within the 10 benefit categories. So, for example, rehabilitative services and habilitative services, services that help you regain function in terms of rehab services or maintain or gain new functionality in terms of habilitative services. States were allowed to make some changes within that particular EHB benefit category. So it'll be interesting for us to figure out whether, for example, in that benefit category, whether rehabilitative services got beefed up at the expense of habilitative services, which are really important to kids with special health care needs. We're also wondering about having to pay a separate premium for standalone pediatric dental plans. Did that blunt the impact of having pediatric oral health services in the EHBs? It's one thing to have a benefit on paper. It's another to actually be able to use it and access care. So we'll be interested in seeing whether that really had an effect. My guess is we're going to see that it did. The question will be to what extent. Transparency requirements in the ACA, although delayed for now, will help inform our understanding of the impacts on MCH populations as a whole, but kids with special health care needs in particular, as well as informing the planned reevaluation by HHS of the benchmark approach for plans in 2016, although the time is getting really tight for them to be doing that. Affordable premiums and cost sharing. We've talked a little bit about cost-sharing limits and the consumer protections already, and the Catalyst Center website has a lot of discussion about these topics on our website. I direct your attention there for a little bit more detail, in-depth detail. I did want to touch for just a moment, though, on the significance of CHIP to children with special health care needs. Kathy alluded to this in her presentation in terms of CHIP refunding. So CHIP was reauthorized up until 2019. But the funding attached to it, the money for states to actually run the program, was only authorized up until next year. So the big debate that's going on in Congress now is, what are we going to do with CHIP? Are we going to refund it as is? Are we going to make changes to it? Are we going to refund it temporarily and reevaluate our options? Are we just going to let it go? Because, you know, those kids can just go ahead and get marketplace coverage now, right? The point in reauthorizing funding in CHIP, it was an important source of coverage for kids pre-ACA, but we still need it. It's still important. Kids can get coverage in subsidized plans in the marketplace around the same income eligibility as you see in CHIP, but analysis from a variety of sources, including the GAO, says that it's not 100% accurate to say it's an apples-to-apples comparison. While coverage is available, even with subsidies, the cost sharing is significantly higher in the marketplace plans, so there's going to be an increased financial burden on families if their kids go out, especially their kids with special health care needs who are higher utilizers of health care services, if they move from CHIP coverage to the marketplace. CHIP's benefits were also designed specifically with pediatric population in mind. The marketplaces, even with the essential health benefits, were not. So this is a concern that we want to keep an eye on and watch.
Thank you.
Talk faster. Last but certainly not least, I want to spend a few moments on access to care and specifically network adequacy in terms of kids with special health care needs. Robust provider networks, a nice robust array of different kinds of primary care and specialty care providers that enrollees in a specific plan can get access to, and they can be guaranteed under contract to be paid for their services, are really important. It results in access without delay to the clinicians and services that enrollees need, and that the benefit descriptions provide. So when a person signs up for a health insurance plan, they're basically entering into a contract with the insurer. The insurer says, you have access to these benefits. If they have a narrow provider network, the real-world application of that list of benefits on paper is worth about the paper that it's written on if you can't get in to get the service. So there's been a trend throughout the healthcare market, but in specifically concern around the QHPs, the qualified health plans in the marketplaces, around narrow networks as a way of controlling costs. So the ACA said that there's no pre-existing condition exclusions anymore, so insurers have to let everybody in who qualifies for their plan. There are also limits on what they're allowed to charge, so they're looking at their bottom line, they're looking at their expenses. One way to control costs, which is still allowed, is to narrow the provider network. The EHBs require them to have a broader array of benefits, so they're looking at narrowing their networks as a way of controlling their costs. One thing that we've heard from folks is, well, it's really not that big a deal that you have a narrow network. All you need is a benefit exception. You need some kind of administrative process where people can say, they can make the case for, my kid with special health care needs this specific kind of service, and okay, if we decide that you've made an adequate case, then we'll go ahead and cover it. That's not an adequate response to this issue. I want to give you an example specifically from Seattle Children's Hospital. So Seattle Children's Hospital in the first year of operation under the ACA was left out a lot of the marketplace plans. It wasn't included in the provider network. So the response was, well, we'll have a benefit exception process. If kids really need their care there, you make a case to us and we'll pay for that. In the first 6 months of this year, Seattle Children's Hospital put in over 1,000 requests for approval of coverage, based on the needs of their pediatric population and the enrollees that this applied to. And 85% of those benefit exceptions were approved. So there's one school of thought that says, well, that worked. You know, 85% of those kids who needed care, they got it. They got it covered. But if the goal was to control costs by narrowing the network, it didn't work for insurers because they ended up paying for the care anyway for 85% of that population. And kids experienced delays in care, Their families were frustrated, confused, and burdened with additional paperwork, and we all know that families of kids with special health care needs, what they want more than anything in the world is more paperwork. And the hospital had to hire 3 additional staff members to deal with their side of all the paperwork. It was an administrative nightmare for everyone involved. And so the idea that you're going to narrow the network, but you're going to have this safety net with benefit exceptions, it's really not a cost-effective solution to the problem. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a regulator. It's not my place to say whether somebody is in compliance with the ACA or not, but I think for those folks who are, there's a case that they can make that narrow networks are discriminatory based on health status, and there are specific provisions in the ACA that prevent this. The Children's Hospital Association has been vocal on this topic. They've been working with a variety of different consumer partners and provider partners to make sure that the needs of kids with special health care needs are at the forefront of this conversation, because as we all know, kids in general don't get thought of first off when it comes to health policy issues, and kids with special health care needs are even less frequently thought of. So they've been working hard. The National Association of Insurance Commissioners has been working on revising its Model Act, dealing with network adequacy. And the feds have yet to weigh in on the topic. So there's still movement in this happening. I think it bears watching, and I think it's really important to this particular population. Primary and specialty care capacity, you all are probably familiar with the fact that there were workforce development provisions in the ACA to try to get more folks in the healthcare delivery pipeline. Whether those are really going to shake out for kids with special healthcare needs in terms of pediatrics and also rural providers remains to be seen. It takes time to raise docs and other clinicians, so we don't know yet if those investments are really going to pay off and to what extent, but that's something that we want to keep an eye on as well. Preventative services with no cost sharing. This was touched on in the presentation on adolescent services. Since the law was passed, 18.6 million kids have received preventative services with no cost sharing. And that includes the developmental and behavioral screenings under Bright Futures. So that's good for kids with special health care needs. It's good for their care. It's good for early identification, early intervention of their health care problems, and hopefully improving their health and well-being and also controlling costs into the future. So kids with special health care needs were, by and large, covered prior to the ACA under insurance and financial hardship, with the primary challenges they and their families faced: continuity of coverage, adequate benefits, affordability, access to care, are continuing concerns post-ACA implementation. We have spent the past 4 years since the ACA passed in 2010 deciding what is health care reform. Now we're moving into the phase where we're going to start deciding what it all means. Now that we know what it is and it's all starting to shake out in the real world, analysis, research, data collection on what it all means in terms of the real world impacts of the ACA is going to have to start. It's early in the life of the ACA, but I think it's something that we'll all have to stay tuned around, and I invite you to come back again next year and hear the panel. We'll have more for you then. Thanks.